I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views. On this edition of Parallax Views, America is in a tense place right now, a moment of multiple crises. How did we get here, though? The esteemed professor and noted public intellectual, Noam Chomsky, lays it out for us on this very special edition of Parallax Views. Now, I could say much more, but let's be honest here. Noam Chomsky needs no introduction. He is, after all, one of America's foremost intellectuals, an astute critic of neoliberalism, and an ardent supporter of democracy, whose voluminous writings span decades. I will note, however, that this conversation was recorded right before the protests that took the nation by storm after the police killing of George Floyd. With that in mind, let's dive right into the conversation with Noam Chomsky. But first, a word from our sponsor.
My name is Joseph L. Flatley, and I'm a journalist who specializes in conspiracy theories and French culture. Over the years, I've met cultists and occultists, flat earthers, and doomsday bunker salesmen, to name only a few. One thing I hear often is that the end of the world is near, and these days, you have to wonder if there might be some truth to that. My new podcast is called Failed State Update. Through interviews and original reporting, each episode asks the question, is the world ending, or does it just seem like it is? Think of it as fresh air for the Orwellian dystopia we've suddenly found ourselves in. Available now on iTunes, Spotify, Anchor, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Parallax Views podcast, Professor Noam Chomsky. How are you doing today?
Very good.
So, Professor Chomsky, you've seen so much of the history within the 20th century from, you know, the rise of Hitler. I've seen you talk about hearing the speeches of Adolf Hitler in various other interviews. And now we're at this moment of crisis. How do you think we got here? What is the big takeaway right now in this crisis, COVID-19, climate change? Where do you think we stand in things?
Well, there's one very simple answer. It's called capitalism. And under capitalist principles, when you carry out actions, say production, you don't pay attention to what are called externalities, the effects on others. So take climate change. If you produce fossil fuels, you try to make a profit, but you're not charged for the fact that you're destroying the prospects for human life. That's not a cost. That's an externality. Okay? That's the basic root of climate change. What about the pandemic? It's kind of the same. Back in 2003, scientists were warning that this is right after the SARS epidemic, which was a coronavirus. Scientists were warning, look, there's another one probably coming. We have to prepare for it. We know how to do it. We can start working on various kinds of preparations, exploring coronaviruses, finding out how to make vaccines and so on. But it's not enough to have the information. Somebody has to do something with it. Well, the obvious candidate is the drug companies. The huge profits granted to them by the so-called free trade agreements, which give them virtually monopoly pricing rights, bulging with profits. They have all the labs and so on, but there's no profit in it. So why should they do it? Well, in fact, as Milton Friedman, the guru of neoliberalism, informed us, corporations have only one responsibility, profit. Okay? Anything else, foundations of civilization collapse. So they're out. Well, there is another possibility. The government, which does public funding, is involved in most of the research and development anyway. But the government is blocked by something else. You recall Ronald Reagan's inaugural address, government is the problem, not the solution. That's the official origin of the 40 years of neoliberalism, which means that everything has to be handed over to private power, which is unaccountable to the public, so it can just seek profit. Anything that's accountable to the public has to be undermined and destroyed, government action. So the government is blocked. Well, then we proceed. Although the government is kind of blocked by the neoliberal plague that we've been living under for 40 years, we know its consequences. I don't have to run through them. Nevertheless, there are things that could be done. So George H.W. Bush, the first Bush, did establish a science advisory board for the president, special advisory board. And Obama, when he came into office, one of his first acts was to call it and request that they provide a pandemic preparation system. And within a couple of weeks, they came out with a system for preparing for an expected pandemic. And a fair number of preparations were made. Then Trump comes into office in January 2017. Within 2 or 3 days of taking office, he disbanded the whole thing. At end of it, no preparation. There's a reason. Trump holds up a populist sign saying, I love you. But in fact, he is a slave to private power and corporate power. All, just take a look at his legislative programs. Everything that's done is to benefit wealth and corporate power, without exception. The rhetoric is to try to keep people mobilized. That's a great con man. He's carrying it off very well. But there's no profit to be made in preparing for a pandemic, so let's get rid of it. He also canceled programs of scientists working in China with Chinese scientists to identify coronaviruses. So let's kill that. He, from the first moment in office, he started defunding the Center for Disease Control, did it every year. In fact, continued to do the plan to do it even after the pandemic struck. So yes, the US is singularly unprepared. And there are basically three reasons: capitalist logic, neoliberal savagery, and the mendacity of a particular administration. Not profound.
In this regard, if I could just pick your brain about this, it seems like in this moment, we have people that want to blame China, or they think that this problem only starts with Trump, or they have wild conspiracy theories about COVID-19. I think your explanation is the best. You have said in previous interviews that it's a market failure. Why do so many of us have trouble thinking in those structural terms, this idea that it is a market failure that has been coming for a long time?
There are strong pressures against looking at the way our basic institutions function. Many people would like to have faith in the what they're taught in school, what they're taught in you know, the doctrinal system and so on. So somehow we're wonderful. There must be some other thing, extraneous thing, that's causing these problems. So maybe it's China, or maybe it's Trump. Actually, to a significant extent, it is Trump, but it goes back much before him. I mean, just take, in addition to what I just described, let's take a look at the health system. The US has the worst health system in the world. It's the only major country that doesn't have some form of universal health care. It has a privatized system, which is highly inefficient. It causes an estimated 70,000 deaths a year just from lack of insurance. It's extremely expensive. Wastes, again, estimated about $500 million a year. Compared with other developed countries, it has twice the costs and some of the worst outcomes. And the hospitals are run by a business model. A business model says you don't have spare capacity. If you're producing automobiles, you don't have an extra assembly line just in case the first one breaks down. That wouldn't be profitable. If you run hospitals that way, it means you don't have an extra bed. You have just enough to get by in normal times. Anything goes wrong, it's a catastrophe. No extra diagnostic capacity, rural areas, hospitals cut down. Private hospitals are quite prosperous, and in fact getting grants from the stimulus program, but they don't have spare capacity either. Well, when you have a society that's run on a business model, it's going to be a disaster for most of the population. Okay, it's very good for some people. So let's take a look at the neoliberal years, 40 years. What have they succeeded in doing? Highly concentrating wealth to unheard of levels. By now, about 0.1%, not 1%, 0.1% of the population has 20% of the country's wealth. Half the population has negative net worth, meaning liabilities greater than assets. An estimated roughly 70%, numbers aren't precise, of the population is essentially getting by from week to week, one paycheck to the next. Anything goes wrong, they're in trouble. Actually, the United States does have a universal healthcare system. It's called emergency rooms. So if you can drag yourself to an emergency room, they'll take care of you. Sometimes very good care. The cruelest, most expensive, savage system of universal health care that exists. But that's what you're stuck with in a business-run society, which is aimed at profit for the few, not the needs of the many. And it's much easier not to look at that. You know, it takes a little thought to look at that. It doesn't take any thought to say, oh, the Chinese are screwing us, or something came out of it. Lab or something, or the World Health Organization is run by China. These things come off the tip of your tongue. Very easy. To look at what's really happening takes a few minutes thought, a few minutes. It's not hidden. It's right near the surface.
In this regard, I wanted to ask you as well, there's been op-eds in the past few years, especially since the 2016 election, saying that, you know, maybe we have too much democracy. That's how Trump got to power, is too much democracy. You have not betrayed the value of democracy. You believe that we must have democracy, that that's our only hope. And I agree with you on that. Why do you think the cause of democracy is something we shouldn't give up on?
Have two choices. I would like to make a comment about these recent op-eds, but let me first answer the question. We have two choices. We have the choice of being in a society which aims for individuals to have equal voice and to make decisions, hopefully informed decisions on the basis of equality of information and opportunity. It's one possibility. The other possibility is to elect some autocrats who will tell us what to do. Okay, it's called dictatorship. And you can choose that if you want. I don't advise you. But now let me make a comment about the op-eds. That goes back to the origins of American democracy, the leading scholarly work on the Constitution, most highly regarded scholarly work and a very fine work by Michael Klarman, is called The Framers' Coup, How the Framers Carried Out a Coup Against the Popular Demand for Democracy. And the reason is they didn't want democracy. And for one thing, almost all of them were slave owners. What do they want democracy for? And the leading framers, like Madison, made it very clear and explicit in the Constitutional Convention that a prime concern of the government is to, I'm quoting, to protect the minority of the opulent against the majority. Now that's what we have to do. And the Constitution was devised for that. Population didn't accept it. There's been a lot of struggle over the years to try to break down this conception and extend democracy. It's a long struggle. But let's just go up to the 20th century, early 20th century. After the First World War, there was a lot of... First World War, Woodrow Wilson established a commission, Creel Commission it was called, to try to propagandize the population, to try to get a pacifist population, to try to agree to fighting the war he wanted to get into in Europe. Population didn't want it, so he had to have a lot of propaganda. Creel Commission was set up and it was very successful. Within about a year, it had turned most of the people into raving anti-German fanatics. You know, the Boston Symphony couldn't play Beethoven, that sort of thing. It was very successful. There were people on the Creel Commission. One of them was Walter Lippmann, the most respected public intellectual of the 20th century. Wilson, Roosevelt, Kennedy, liberal. He wrote what were called progressive essays in democracy, basing himself, as he said, in part on the achievements of the Creel Commission. He said, democracy is a bad thing. These are progressive essays, incidentally. I'm not talking about the right, much worse. This is the liberal left. Democracy is dangerous. People are too, don't know what they're doing. The people are simply a bewildered herd. And the responsible men, that's us, must be protected from the roar and trampling of the bewildered herd. The population has a role. They're supposed to show up every 4 years and push a button, and then they go back and leave things to their betters. Another member of the Creel Commission was Edward Bernays, the founder of the modern public relations industry. He has an important book called Propaganda. It wasn't a bad word in those days, which is the founding document of the enormous public relations industry. And he has the same message. He said, our goal is what he called engineering of consent. Lippmann called it manufacture of consent. The public are too stupid and ignorant. We can't let them do what they want. So we have to engineer consent in the interests of good policy, which we, the smart guys, will implement. That's what the whole huge public relations industry is about, trying to get you to believe something, to want something that you didn't know you wanted, and so on. Well, okay, that's the liberals, the founder, one of the founders of modern political science, another liberal, Kennedy, Roosevelt liberal, Harold Laswell, wrote that we should not be under the illusions of democratic dogmatisms, which believe that people are the best judges of their own interest. They're not. We are, me and my friends, we're the best judges. So we have to control the bewildered herd and marginalize them somehow. Well, let's come to the 1970s. One of them is an organization. In the 1970s, elites were terrified by the rise of democracy. Here's the rabble standing up and demanding a voice in public affairs. What are called special interests, young people, women, elderly, farmers, workers, they're all trying to get into the act and say, we have a voice. We can't have that. That's a terrible threat to good order. Now, there were two reactions to this. One on the right, Powell Memorandum, important to organize the business community, to use its resources to fight back and to beat down this effort to have some democracy. The other was on the left, much more interesting. It's the Trilateral Commission. That's basically the Carter administration. Liberal internationalists from the main state capitalist centers, United States, Europe, and Japan. And they say the same thing. Their book, they have a book in the early 70s called The Crisis of Democracy. There's too much democracy. We have to have more moderation in democracy. We have to control, I'm quoting, the institutions responsible for the indoctrination of the young. The colleges, schools, the churches, they are responsible for the indoctrination of the young. They're failing. Look at all these young kids in the streets, and they're calling for rights for women, for ending the war. We can't tolerate that. Remember, this is the left. Okay? We can't tolerate that. We have to have more moderation in democracy. They have to go home, leave power in the hands of their betters. This is a strain that runs from the founding of the country right up until today. Those are the op-eds you're talking about. Elites, including liberal elites, have been appalled by the notion of democracy. It goes much farther back in history, but I won't go into that. Meanwhile, the public keeps struggling for it. That's a major conflict that's torn the country apart for 2.5 centuries. So yes, it's coming up again.
If I could, I just had one final question. I've been reading a lot lately about the Indonesian massacres of 65 and 66, which you spoke out against. Those were backed by forces within the US system. And it seems as if those right-wing forces that led to these massacres, it seems as if they're still very much present throughout the world, fanatically ideological in the Philippines with Duterte and in Brazil with Bolsonaro. Is history repeating itself, and can we stop this reactionary tide?
Well, there is a, first of all, there, you have to recall that in the interim period, there were quite progressive tides. So take Brazil, the first 10 years of this decade, or what the World Bank, not a liberal institution, what the World Bank calls the golden decade of Brazil's history under the Lula government, with great advances in reduction of poverty, inclusiveness, bringing marginalized population into the center of into universities, into policy making, and so on. Then there's a reaction to it. Okay, things like this go on all the time. Now you take the neoliberal period. It's had a very hard. It's been magnificent for corporations and ultra wealth. They've done fantastically. Not for the rest of the population of the world. The statistics I mentioned of the United States are more a little different in other countries, but pretty much the same. For most of the world's population, the neoliberal period has been very harmful. Well, it's also reduced democracy almost everywhere. So if you concentrate power enormously and you say government is the problem, the power that's concentrated is going to run the government even more than it usually does. So functioning democracy declines. And people know it. They don't have to read political science journals to know that they don't, their own representatives don't pay any attention to them. They're listening to other voices. The same elsewhere. Europe, in many ways, is even worse. The European Union transferred decision-making from states to an unelected bureaucracy in Brussels. That's where the decisions are made, unelected, okay? And people know that. Well, all of this leads to a reaction among the public. Anger, the disillusionment, the resentment, hatred of institutions. That can lead in many different ways. It can lead towards reversing the process and developing a functioning democratic system, or it can be fertile terrain for demagogues, the Trump type, the type, the confidence man, who stands up with a banner saying, I love you, and with the other hand stabs you in the back. Can be that. And we're seeing both. The question, we're seeing it right now. What comes out of this pandemic is being worked on right now. Those who want to, who created the system, benefited from it, want to restore it in an even harsher form, with more controls, with more surveillance and so on, tools developed. And they're working on it. If others don't work to counter it, they'll win. We'll also have another pandemic because it's just like 2003. Scientists are telling us right now, another one's coming. It's going to be worse because of global warming. You got to do something now, but now you're faced with the same barriers that I mentioned before. It's all possible. It's possible to overcome it all. But if you don't get involved and engaged and active, it's going to happen. The guys who created the current system will create the next one, even worse and harsher.
Professor Chomsky, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views. I always like to end on a positive note. I know it's very dark times, but what would you say to my listeners that maybe would inspire them not to give up hope, to keep fighting and keep themselves in this struggle that we find ourselves in?
Well, first thing I would do is look at history. If you go back and think of what things were like not too long ago, they're much better now. Much better. And people don't, we don't look at the past, we live in the present moment. That's a bad idea. So let's go back to the 60s, say. Okay. The 1960s, the US had racist laws so extreme that the Nazis refused to accept them. For example, mixed marriage was banned by law if you could find one drop of blood in one of the partners, and the other was white, okay? Even the Nazis wouldn't accept that. That was the law until the 60s. Till the 1960s, women were property, not peers, under the law, British common law from the 18th century. That changed finally in 1975 under the pressure of the feminist movement. The 1960s, federally subsidized housing was segregated by law, no blacks. And that deprived the black population of the chance to enter into the world. The wealth in the United States is mostly property, they were cut out. That's the 1960s. Now, there were anti-sodomy laws until 15 years ago. I mean, all of this has been overcome. It wasn't a gift that we fought for, struggled for. That's the crisis of democracy, people struggling for those things. And that goes right back through history. And the same is true today. So there's plenty of reason to hope. There's lots of opportunities. Now we have a legacy that has placed struggle on a higher level. There are a lot of questions that don't have to be fought for anymore. They were won by earlier generations. Okay, we can move on. There's another reason for optimism. Very simple one. You have only two choices. You can say, too much trouble, hopeless, I don't want to bother, and you can help ensure that the worst will happen. Or you can say, look, there are opportunities. It's going to be a hard struggle the way it always was. But if I engage in it, we can get a better world. That's not much of a choice.
Well, I appreciate that you've kept the hope through all these years, and I appreciate the work you've done. Casey, do you want to lead us out?
All right, comrades, stay safe, stay strong, still stay at least 2 meters apart. Solidarity forever.
Great, that's right. See you guys later.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed our conversation with the esteemed professor and public intellectual, Noam Chomsky. Let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at @viewsparallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Also, if you can, please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. In these rather difficult times, I hope that you are all staying safe and that these programs are in some small way helping you get through these difficult times. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.